I'm Nish Wyseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we're covering the horrific mass shooting in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue, where a white supremacist murdered 11 congregants during Shabbat services. It's thought to be the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history.
We'll also grapple with the tricky question that has become very real in the past few days, which is how to talk with children about anti-Semitism. Not just violence, although that's hard enough, but about the idea that some people may hate them simply because of their religious and ethnic background. We produce this podcast with the generous backing of individuals who support us every month. A special thanks to all the new sponsors who have joined us in the past month. If you like what you hear and think these conversations are valuable, you too can become a sponsor of Impolite Company. Click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. We'd be so grateful for your help.
On the morning of Saturday, October 27th, a white supremacist walked into the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania with an AR-15 and multiple handguns and murdered 11 attendees at the morning Shabbat service. Their names are Joyce Feinberg, Richard Gottfried, Rose Malinger, Jerry Rabinowitz, Cecil Rosenthal, David Rosenthal, Bernice Simon, Sylvan Simon, Daniel Stein, Melvin Wax, and Irving Younger. The dead range in age from 54 to 97, and they were doctors, accountants, dentists, retirees, and all were fixtures in their community and beloved members of the congregation.
The shooter, who we will not name, was taken into custody after exchanging gunfire with a Pittsburgh SWAT team, and he reportedly told officers that, quote, all Jews should die, unquote. He left a trail of social media posts attacking a Jewish organization that assists refugees, and he echoed Trump language referring to refugees as violent and calling them invaders. The Tree of Life massacre took place in a month that has seen a dozen Trump critics targeted with pipe bombs, including billionaire George Soros. Soros, who is Jewish, has also been the target of escalating rhetorical attacks from the NRA, conservative media figures, and even U.S. senators who have falsely accused him of funding protesters during the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and of paying Central American refugees to come to the U.S. Virtually every conservative mention of Soros this fall has fit squarely in the classic playbook of anti-Semitic canards, which is to say, Nish, this was not something that was expected in its particulars, but not unsurprising in the history of anti-Semitism in the West generally, in the United States, and given the level of rhetoric and fear-mongering that we've been hearing from the right. We can't forget that exactly 2 years ago, the closing push of Trump's campaign was a television ad that talked about globalists and Hillary Clinton's connections with globalists. There were all sorts of dog whistles and just outright anti-Semitic criticisms that were intended to fire up those portions of the right and the alt-right that hate Jews. It's as simple as that.
I was at a conference this last weekend, and I was backstage. I had just gotten off the stage with a few of my colleagues. We had done a panel, and or we had each spoken, and then we did a panel. And so then our time was up, and we came backstage, and the next panel came up, and it was great, fantastic panel. And then the organizer of the conference came up on stage and had broken the news. And he was like, during this last session, you know, a horrible thing has happened. and proceeded to tell us what had happened. In that moment, it was like the air got sucked out of the room. It was the most like horrifying moment. It was so emotional. It was horrific. Like, you could hear the audience outside gasp. And of course, this was a Christian conference, and the Reverend Dr. Will Gaffney came up and gave this beautiful prayer in solidarity with the Jewish community and talked about how, as Christians, it's our responsibility to stand in solidarity with the Jewish community now and always, but specifically right now in their grief. I know this is going to sound really cynical, but like, we keep saying like, oh, it's going to get better, right? Like, things are going to get better. Things are going to be better. And they're oftentimes not. Things sometimes don't get better. Sometimes things get worse. And we see the rise of anti-Semitic attacks since Donald Trump has taken office, like, escalate exponentially. And it's just a reminder that the hatred of the Jewish community and Jewish people and the Jewish religion and Jewish culture is still so prevalent, even here in the United States. Rose Malinger, who was one of the victims, was 97 years old and lived through the survival of the Holocaust. And yet she was killed at 97 by a white supremacist in America in an anti-Semitic attack. Like, sometimes things don't always get better. Sometimes they cycle back around, and sometimes things get worse. And it's just a really harrowing time in our history, and it's really terrible. And I just don't know what to do about it. Without being like, you know, wrought with despair, like, certainly there has to be more we can do. Certainly there has to be something we can do, but it all just feels very dark. It feels very hopeless at the moment, which I know, like I said, maybe cynical, but I just had to be honest about like how I'm feeling about it and how terrible it is. And I'm, you know, in a Christian home with a Christian family, like, I can't imagine what it must be like for you and your husband, who, your husband is Jewish and you are raising interfaith kids. Like, I can't imagine how that must feel and how dangerous it must feel right now.
Well, and just to add another bit of context for this particular violence, the day before, two Black Americans were murdered in the parking lot of a grocery store in Louisville, Kentucky, by another right winger, a white supremacist, who, before he shot them there, had gone to a predominantly Black church and attempted to open the doors. And it was only because they were locked that he could not go in, because the indications are that he had wanted to do what Dylann Roof did and murder people in a Black church. It's been a little surreal to go through this and think about it and talk about it here in Evanston for a couple of different reasons. One is that for all its faults and eccentricities, living in DC, I actually felt very safe because it was such a security conscious city, and because our children got used to the fact. I mean, they didn't know any different. The JCC that we went to and where our daughter was in preschool had guards, and we went through a metal detector to go through. And when that's what you're used to, it's not frightening. The synagogue where she had gone to preschool before that had guards. There aren't any guards here at the synagogue where our son now goes to preschool. And the security procedures are pretty, I am a little hesitant to even go into it because, you know, I don't want people knowing too much about it. And I know that the chances are that nothing is going to happen there. But I also know that I feel more strongly about having security there than I do at our public school. You know, I think we've talked before about the fact that I don't want my children going through lockdown drills in their schools, especially their public schools. I think that it has, the research shows that it creates an unhealthy and inaccurate ability to assess risk, and has created a generation of super stressed out kids who expect a school shooting. But given the history of Jews in America, there is just a pragmatism that is necessary about the need for security. And, just to go back to what I mean about being here in Evanston, I'm forgetting how many years ago it was now, I think probably 20. There was a white supremacist who shot and killed a number of people, injured many more in the Evanston Skokie area, targeted because Skokie has a large Jewish population, particularly Orthodox Jewish population. And one of his victims was the Black basketball coach at Northwestern. So this is a community that has felt violence that was motivated by racism and anti-Semitism before. And because we belong to a Black church and because we belong to a synagogue, it is something that we think about a lot. There was a vigil at our synagogue, and our pastor of our church was there because they're sister congregations and because they also understand it may not be a shared history in that they're targeted for the same reason, but it's a shared history of persecution nonetheless. We'll get into this later, but what's been tough is we have talked to the kids about racism and the fact that there were and still are people who hate other people because of their skin color. We have largely not spoken about anti-Semitism. And it wasn't that we weren't ever going to, but it's one of those things that it's unclear when the right time is. And well, for our older child now, it's going to be the right time. But we've read, because we're always reading books about, famous and courageous women. So we've read books about some of the women who helped shelter Jews during World War II. And they've asked questions occasionally about, what was going on and why Jews needed sheltering. And I've answered them as accurately as I can without scaring them. But I've also answered it as a concern of the past and not something that is ongoing.
Well, I'm with you. In our house, we don't have the news. We don't have cable news. I don't listen to NPR in the car anymore with my kids. I actually stopped that after the Parkland shooting. So that's just not something that we do anymore. Not because we don't have cable TV, for a lot of reasons, one of which it's just a racket. But number two is we just don't want that sort of noise in our life all the time. And we don't want that sort of noise and rhetoric in the lives of our kids and in the ears of our kids. And so we don't really listen to it. We don't pay attention to it. We don't have it. And I waver back and forth, right? I go back and forth between, am I keeping my kids in this bubble? Right? Because we do live in a small town, very small town. It's pretty liberal, especially for, Idaho. But we live in a small town. It's pretty liberal. My kids don't really have any context for what's happening politically or in communities that don't look like theirs. And so I struggle. I struggle. Like, am I sheltering my kids? Am I keeping them in a bubble and not being able to engage in some hard questions? And yet I also going, like that any mom, regardless of community, would want, right? That, like, I want my kids to be able to be kids. I want my kids to be able to not, live with that kind of stress and worry and fear. And so I go back and forth between what I expose my kids to, when should I even Do I just let it be? Like, there's all these kind of questions. And I know I am saying this out of a space of very deep privilege. Like, I am able to not have to have those hard conversations with my kids. Like, now my friends who are Jewish, or my fellow mothers and fathers, not fellow, but my fellow mothers, but who also happen to be moms of color, or who are raising children of color and have to have really hard conversations with their kids at very young ages about the realities of the world. I don't have that burden. I have a deep sense of privilege. And so I also recognize that. And so I really struggle with how much do I expose my kids to, and when, and how do I do that? And what are some tools that I could use to help, you know, tiptoe into that conversation so that my kids aren't necessarily raised in a bubble, but it's doing it in a way that does, you know, preserve their childhood in a way that allows them to ask questions that are age appropriate and in a way that would actually be meaningful and formational to them as people. So I don't know if you have any resources or thoughts about that, but I struggle just as, like, you know, privileged white mom living in small town America. Like, how do I talk to my kids about this?
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, of course, in many ways, we want to protect our children forever.
Of course.
But, you know, and please don't ever leave or date or anything. But
especially date.
The first time we started thinking about this was when Finney was in public school in DC, and because she was in a school that was 90% children of color, there were all sorts of things that were just taken for granted in a good way, I think. And that, you know, for Black History Month, man, did they learn a lot. And learn from the perspective that I think is right, which is not that, you know, the civil rights leaders were these anodyne, peaceful, you know, Disneyfied versions of people, but that they were political and they were activists and they were passionate. And we struggled a little bit until it was just impossible to avoid the fact that her friends' parents did not have that luxury. And her friends didn't have that luxury. They knew from much younger ages than she what their skin color meant. And yet with anti-Semitism, it's been a little different. Now, we did take the kids to Israel a couple of years ago, and they noticed, as it is hard to notice, that there are soldiers with automatic weapons everywhere, that when you go into a shopping mall or you go into a restaurant, there will be somebody guarding the door and possibly checking your bag. And so we talked about what that meant for Israel. We talked about what that meant for their cousins who are in Israel, because again, their parents don't have the luxury of waiting to discuss it. But it has now kind of come here. And so I've looked up a few resources. The preschool synagogue, or the synagogue preschool, did send out some resources to parents because it is all very young children. They advised saying nothing about this particular incident to our kids, which just because of the ages of ours is going to be difficult. I have to assume that, you know, for third graders, somebody in school might mention it. And so we do need to talk to Finney. And because we're talking to her, we need to talk to her little brother, which is going to be tricky. But one of the suggestions here, which I think works better probably for Jewish children who are very familiar with these stories, is so many of the holidays revolve around stories of Jews being persecuted by those who hate them for being Jewish. And You know, whether it's Purim in the story of Esther or the Maccabees or Moses and the Israelites fleeing Egypt, they are extremely familiar with the concept of people at some point in history hating the Jews, and people at some point in history hating people who live in Israel. I hate to have to update that and tell them that, in fact, just like we talk about with Uncle Kwesi and how people who are Black still do not have the same experience with justice and with the assumption of safety, particularly when they are dealing with law enforcement, that there are some people who will still have this view of Jews, and where it will be kind of tricky for us, I suspect, is because we've been walking a very thin line in talking to the kids about the fact that they draw their lineage from both of us, and so they are Christian and Jewish. Because depending on the day, they both want to be Christian because mama's Christian, or they both want to be Jewish. In fact, we had just last Friday had a Shabbat dinner with the families of the kids in his class. And he does so much toddler splaining. So he was doing some Cormac splaining to prepare me for Shabbat. And it went along the lines of, now, Mama, I know you're Christian, but there are going to be some Jewish songs here. So you just like follow my lead was basically the gist of that. And I had to be like, yeah, buddy. So I do know some of these songs. And in fact, the one we sing for the blessing, the Hamotzi prayer, is sung to the tune of a very old hymn that I sang, you know, growing up in the Baptist church. But it was very sweet that he's having a hard time wrapping his head around why I would do some Jewish things, even though I'm not Jewish. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to add anything to the equation that's going to push him over to like, yeah, that's all interesting and all, but I'm just going to stay over here on the Christian side because that seems to be a little safer. Mm. So maybe I will report back. I don't know. It's going to be, you know, something for our family to figure out, but not something we were looking forward to talking about. Mm-hmm. But as you say, also not something that we can afford to ignore right now.
Yeah. I want to ask you a couple of questions. One of them is a little personal, but I think it's helpful for people to kind of hear how these sort of things impact people within the broader Jewish community. Like, how are you doing personally? How is Nome feeling? Obviously, you haven't talked to your kids about it, but you know, how are you processing? Like, what are some of the things that you do to help process this sort of information and these sort of events that obviously feel a little close to home? How are you guys doing? Like, how is your family handling this information?
To be honest, to be completely honest, I am scared for my kids, but at the same time, it seems a little remote. I mean, it's horrifying, no question about that. So was the shooting in Sutherland Springs. They were not targeted for their faith, but it was a massacre of people attending services nonetheless. So was the shooting at Mother Emanuel. They were targeted for their race and their faith. You know, I certainly don't want to say I am numb to it, but I guess my anger has kind of numbed my grief, if that makes sense. You know, I long before I knew I would end up marrying somebody who was Jewish, I was taking classes on, I always forget the name of the course, but it was at Michigan, and it was basically how the church dealt with Judaism and Jews in basically the Middle Ages up through the Enlightenment era. And so probably more than most Christians, I've done a lot of reading on this and been very aware of just how deep this pernicious and persistent hatred goes, and how untethered from reality it is. And that may be the scariest thing to me, is it is hard, hard to see how you combat it. I mean, obviously there are organizations like the Anti-Defamation League and others that have been working for a century or more. And yet I still don't think we have great answers. I mean, if nothing else, what this past week with the pipe bombs and the shooting in Kentucky and now the massacre in Pittsburgh, what it has brought home is in an even more visceral way than I already understood, that it's not going to get better, and that Trump is not going to stop seeding the crazies and the hateful out there with the kind of rhetoric that will incite them. And he's not going to stop because it helps him, because authoritarians always benefit from fear.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's something about knowing that, and then there's something about seeing the consequences of that and knowing that he just doesn't give a shit. He's just going to keep doing it regardless of who gets killed and who is terrified because of it, because it is a political strategy that benefits him. And right now it benefits the entire Republican Party. And so they're going to keep letting it happen. It is knowing for sure that we all knew he was going to be off his rocker and willing to do or say anything, but knowing for sure that nobody in the Republican Party is going to actually do anything to stop it or make it change, and that precious few people in conservative religious circles are willing to do anything and speak out. It has been those large groups of people who could still do something and are choosing not to that has been the most difficult to take, I think.
Because we know that Trump is certainly not going to do anything. If anything, he's going to make it worse, because that's just who he is. And we know that, aside from, you know, a very enthusiastic tweet, like, no one's really going to stand up and do anything and make sure that, you know, there are protections or anything else put into place to make sure this doesn't happen again. What are some things that the everyday person can do to stand in solidarity with, to offer support to advocate for, to stand as an ally to the Jewish community in America in the face of rising anti-Semitism? What are some of the actual things that just your average person, what can I do in my everyday life to help stand in solidarity with the Jewish community right now?
Well, one thing is to read up on anti-Semitism, and that does not require checking books out of the library. Just in the past 3 days, the Washington Post has had a series of really excellent articles, some by scholars, some by just political observers, outlining what anti-Semitism looks like these days and how very little it has changed, and pointing out all the various ways in which the alt-right and white nationalists and anti-Semites have been thrilled with Trump. And I think just knowing that and having your eyes open is useful. I would say another thing is recognizing the American Jewish community for the specific demographic that it is. And by that, I mean, one of the things that probably enraged me the most in the past few days since the shooting was Kellyanne Conway responding to this like they did after the Mother Emanuel shooting, where conservatives tried to say, oh, this wasn't targeting them because of their race. This was an attack on faith, on people of faith.
Religiosity is a whole.
Yep. She said the same thing here. I'm going to quote it because people need to hear. This is the day after the slaughter that was very clearly an anti-Semitic act. And she said the anti-religiosity in this country, that it's somehow in vogue and funny to make fun of anybody of faith, to constantly be making fun of people who express religion, the late night comedians, the unfunny people on TV shows. It's always anti-religious. And remember, these people were gunned down in their place of worship, as were the people in South Carolina several years ago. And they were there because they're people of faith. And it's that faith that needs to bring us together. This is no time to be driving God out of the public square, which does two things, both of which just curdle my blood. One is it poses her and conservatives as victims right along with the people who were very clearly slaughtered because they are Jewish. And the second is that it continues the act of division and sowing fear and hatred, because it is directly not even pausing for one moment of silence before racing into the grievance politics of, don't forget, they make fun of you, they hate you because you're religious, which is not true, but is also, woman, I give it a rest for one freaking week, even. I think Jewish Americans need to be given the respect of acknowledging that this was because of their faith and their ethnicity.
Yeah. It de-centers the oppressed community. And it's erasure. It's erasure is what it is.
Yes, like it is erasure.
It's erasure. Let's just call it what it is. Like what Kellyanne Conway and so many other people are doing by decentering the anti-Semitic aspect of this. And by aspect, I mean, it's the entire thing.
Yes.
There was no other perspective. It is clearly anti-Semitic. It was an anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish attack on a Jewish community. By decentering that, you're erasing it. Like, you are erasing the grief and pain and oppression of the Jewish community in America and around the world. Like, it is, anti-Semitism is real. It is tangible. It is quantifiable. And it is happening here on a daily basis. And the more that we allow people like Kellyanne Conway and all those dipshits in the White House to say shit like this unchecked, we're allowing that very real perceived oppression, not just perceived oppression, this very real actual oppression to be erased and to sweep it under the rug rather than call it out for what it is and address it.
Yeah, I don't see any difference between what she said and the people who insist on pointing out that it wasn't just Jews who were killed in the Holocaust. They put gypsies in the camps too. They put gay people in the camps. It's not Holocaust denial, but it is erasure of Jews. You're absolutely right, and I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, it's the erasure of Jews. It is infuriating. It's infuriating to me. Like, call it for what it is.
Because then it also excuses anything that Trump may have said or any other conservatives may have said to encourage anti-Semites, because all of a sudden that's not the cause. That's not the motivation. Mm-hmm.
The thing that I have found really frustrating, and you're a journalist, so you may have some specific feedback on this, but one of the things that's been really frustrating to me, whether it is this statement or statements about the explosive devices sent to political critics of Trump, or whether it's even Trump today saying that he's going to, like, that he wants to essentially eradicate the 14th Amendment by executive action, which is like, it's terrifying, but also I'm really so thankful that he's a fucking idiot and doesn't understand how the Constitution works. But where people say things like this, whether it has to do with erasure, whether it has to do with the president saying dumb shit, that we let people say this, and then journalists, at least on TV, let it go unchecked, like right there. And that's what I'm really struggling with these days, is that we're allowing these news clips and everything else to be put out there. And we're like, oh, look at this dumb thing that they said, and look at this horrible thing that they said. But then we don't actually see the person interviewing the person that said the dumb thing check them about that dumb thing. And that's been really frustrating to me, because then it allows that narrative to perpetuate in some ways. And so I don't know, like, is there a role that news organizations and journalists, specifically on TV, is there a role for them to play in making sure that we are checking those things? Like, I would have loved to see someone like come out forcefully in the moment and like cut off Kellyanne Conway and say like, no, that's like, you're erasing the very real oppression of the Jewish community. Like, it was anti-Semitic, full stop. But no one did. And so I really struggle with that. Is there a role that journalism plays in this that can kind of knock the shit off?
I think there is a role for journalists to play. Just to be very honest, I have been really despairing lately about how not up to the task journalists have been for covering the Trump presidency. And partly it is true, we've never seen anybody like him before. Partly it is true that we're in this horrible business model that rewards the most outrageous thing you can possibly say.
Which is why they have people like Kellyanne Conway.
Like this awful interview. I mean, it's become a thing where you raise just an outlandish proposal and you ask Trump, you know, if he would do it. And he's a dumbass. He doesn't know about any of this stuff. So of course he says, oh yeah. And then they treat that as if it is a like considered presidential decision that he's going to do this. And it's self-perpetuating, because in many cases, the more attention it gets, the more then suddenly somebody within the government needs to get something going so that suddenly there is a tangible proposal. And so the stuff about the 14th Amendment has come up because Axios apparently has a new HBO show. And so it was disgusting that they were promoting it with exciting news. We've got this clip from our new interview and our new TV show. And like, that's not exciting. It actually would impact real people's lives, real people who are not you and who do not have your privilege. And you are acting like this is a game, and it is a game to make money from your ratings.
And that's right.
Drives me insane.
It's infuriating. Well, and like, I mean, this is off topic. We're now like shifting a little bit to the president's comments about, yeah, about the president's comments about eradicating the 14th Amendment, which if you're not aware, the president on Axios essentially said that he would like to do away with what's called birthright citizenship. So if you are the child of an undocumented immigrant in America and you were born here, you would no longer be a citizen, which is certifiably crazy. But
that right stems from the 14th Amendment. And the purpose of that was so that slaves and the children of slaves could get citizenship.
Yes, so that they could become citizens of the United States. It has such deep implications that are so fucked up. Anyway, one of the things that I like thought about as you were talking about, like, yeah, these things have real, like, real implications for real people if they were actually enacted, yes, but just the fact that the president of the United States is laying that on the table is something legitimate to consider. I don't think news organizations are taking the the terror that this incites, specifically in immigrant communities. Like, they're not taking it seriously. Either they are and they don't care, or they are just unaware. Like, those are the two options I have to come, like, that I have concluded. But, like, I don't, it's just infuriating. Like, I was just talking with a friend earlier via text message, and she's like, you can feel the anxiety in the grocery store. And she lives in a, you know, heavily immigrant community, but specifically Latin American community. And so it is like, when he says these things on national television, and it's tweeted and Facebooked, and people are talking about it as if it's a real thing that could really happen, like, that incites fear and terror in real communities today. Like, whether or not he enacts it or not, it instills anxiety and fear in communities here in America, which is wholly unacceptable for a president of the United States to do that. Anyway, that is my piece on that.
Well, so
what were you saying?
A debate that has been ongoing for the last 2 or 3 years in some generalism circles is what it would look like for journalists to stop covering each and every individual thing that Trump says, certainly to stop doing what places like the AP have been doing, which I think is incredibly irresponsible, which is just, you know, transmitting his quotes word for word in tweets without context or without pushing back or without the, you know, with
no correction,
no evidence. But to instead report basically the themes of Trump's presidency. And we have done this with other presidents and with other issue areas. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, when a president is known for a particular economic policy, you know, whether it is promoting free trade, various things that they say or do that are linked to that get reported under that banner. I think that conservatives have been very effective at mau-mauing reporters. And at this point, I don't know, part of me wants to say anybody who doesn't trust mainstream journalists just because we're mainstream journalists is no longer listening to us anyway. So maybe we should even care what they have to say. But then the question is, are you just preaching to the choir? But anyway, what this would look like is instead of just reporting, hey, the president says he may get rid of birthright citizenship, is to say, this is a key piece of the alt-right's, can't really call it a platform, but of what they have been pushing for and talking about over the last decade. It's not, you know, just some off-kilter idea, yeah, that they, you know, pulled up out of a dark corner of the web. Like, this is what these guys talk about. This is what Steve Bannon believes in. If you listen to him, this is what he pushes for. And you need to, you have a responsibility to explain that context in, you know, Trump pushing another piece of white supremacist ideology. That's what he's doing. That is the news. It's just like, you know, we can report each and every one of the, what now, 7,000 lies that he's told in office. And I'm not, that's not hyperbole. Or you can make the lead story on the news that he continues to lie, because he has decided that that works for him and that he has no need to base anything that he says in actual evidence. Occasionally you'll get a story along those lines, but it is not the frame for the news that gets transmitted to people day in, day out. And yet it is the real story of why things are happening. It's not just that we happen to have a president who, you know, is forgetful and, you know, can't remember to tell the truth dozens of times per day.
On the flip side of that, there has been really excellent reporting by some in the media, one of which you can always count on to have a really great nuanced perspective, especially in regards to religion and how it impacts religious communities, is Emma Green, who has been here on the podcast. She has a great, great, great article out today on The Atlantic, and it is about...
We'll have it in our show notes.
Yeah, we will have it in our show
notes. It's about the people who guard Jewish bodies for burial.
Yes, and the role that the broader Jewish community in Pittsburgh has decided to play in the guarding of those bodies, because this is kind of unprecedented, obviously, with so many fatalities. There's just logistics that come into play with the Jewish community and how they actuate those rituals. Emma did such a wonderful job, not just reporting like what are those rituals in the Jewish community and why they're important, but weaving the grief of the community and being very careful with their grief and the importance of these rituals to their faith. Doing that so well in her piece. She is definitely one of those reporters and writers that you can count on to always do that. But anyway, definitely read her piece. There's also some good reporting in the New York Times as well about that ritual, but Emma Green's piece is really quite moving. So you should definitely check it out. And this will always be the bang or the drum that we beat, right? Is pay for good journalism. Like, go pay for good journalism. There are wonderful outlets doing really, really great work, and journalists who are working really, really hard and trying to keep the truth at the forefront and calling the president on his lies. There are journalists doing that, and so make sure you're paying for that good content. It keeps their jobs intact. So please make sure you're paying for good journalism. That is also what I would say. We'll wrap up the show with our praise and petition segment, in which we shout out the things that are bringing us joy and call out the people and situations who are making us cranky. Amy, what is going on with you this week?
Well, there were actually two things that I was going to recommend because I quite enjoyed them in the last week, and then they became relevant in ways that I had not anticipated. So last week, I went on a little writing retreat for 3 or 4 days to give myself some time to focus, and discovered to my dismay that my best work schedule is still completely incompatible with having children, which is to say that I work best when I sleep until, say, 11 in the morning, and then I write and I work until about 8 or 9 at night, and then I binge British television shows until about 3 in the morning, and then I do it all over again. And I make no apologies for it. It worked really well for me last week. And I saw not one, but 2 entire first seasons of different shows that have run in England. So the first of them is a Welsh show. And I have never seen a show that was kind of a Welsh-English hybrid like this. It's called Bang. And it follows a Welsh policewoman, and I won't get into everything, but her brother, who's kind of troubled, and they're trying to still kind of deal with the shooting death of their father several decades earlier. And what's fascinating as an American to watch is not just all the Welsh, and to have a show based in Wales, which I also don't think I've ever watched. But that the whole, maybe 6 episodes, 7 episodes, revolve around a gun. And the fact that like an entire police department is focused on getting a gun off the streets, that they are just petrified. And this gun does end up being responsible, or all the people who wield the gun, for several deaths and several people being injured. But it's just this idea that this one firearm can pose such a threat to a community that I just can't relate to it all as American, but that I wish was our reality. And the second show that I watched dealt with firearms in a similar way. It's The Bodyguard, which is streaming on Netflix right now, starring Rob Stark, actor Richard Madden. So he, in this show, is a former Afghanistan soldier who has PTSD and who is now a civilian serving as like personal security for basically their Homeland Security Secretary. And again, parts of the plot revolve around, the intricate maneuvers that are necessary to obtain a firearm in a country where it is in large part not legal for civilians to have firearms, and particularly not handguns. I probably recommend that one more than Bang, just for pure entertainment. But both of them are just so fascinating for portraying cultures that deal with gun violence in such a very different and, I would say, healthier way than we do. So those are my two recommendations. I also recommend, if you are a working parent, giving yourself a few days, if you can pull it off, to try out your ideal schedule. It'll just make you depressed that you can't stick to it all the time, but it's amazing what you can get done.
That's awesome. Good job,
you. When you're not fighting your body clock.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I was at a conference last weekend, and I mean, it was exhausting. Like, it was one of the best conferences, if not the best conference I've ever been to or participated in ever. Was with so many wonderful people and lots of friends of the podcast. Just a really great time, but man, was I tired. And when I got home, I don't think I've slept that hard. Like, I don't think I moved, actually. So when I got up in the morning, like, my shoulder hurt so bad, it like pinched a nerve or something, because I'd stayed in one position for, I think, like 10 hours and just didn't move. It's amazing what happens when you actually sleep and sleep until you're, not tired anymore. It's remarkable.
Well, what do you have to recommend to us?
Okay. Mine, I was at this conference, but it took many planes to get there. And so I took a flight from Seattle to Atlanta. So I got to watch at least two movies. And I'm going to tell you, one of those movies, you're going to laugh, was Hocus Pocus. You know, the old Bette Midler, Sarah Jessica Parker. Yeah. I watched
it. I do. I never saw it.
What? Oh my gosh. Okay.
I know.
So I watched it as a young teenager, late elementary school kid. And I think that was around the time that I watched it. I can't really remember, but I always loved that movie, and you'd watch it around Halloween, but then it kind of like died away, you didn't really watch it again. But for whatever reason, like, people are making GIFs out of, Bette Midler's character. And so like, it's kind of come back into popular culture. And so it was actually one of the choices that Delta offered in their free movies on their app. And I was like, Hocus Pocus. And I didn't really pay attention to it. But then the girl next to me on the airplane was watching it. And I like tapped her on the shoulder. I was like, is it as good as you remember? And she was like, oh my God, it's so much funnier as a grown up. And I was like, okay. So I watched Hocus Pocus on the airplane, and it is so funny. It is so funny. I totally forgot how great that movie was. I was so happy. I was like, I just really needed a really funny, like, holiday-ish type movie. And it was perfect. It was absolutely perfect. So if you want to, with Halloween happening, well, we're recording this on the 30th. Tomorrow's Halloween, so go watch Hocus Pocus. It's super funny, and I'm actually going to let my kids watch it. That was also one of the reasons why I wanted
to. Oh, you wanted to see if it was
appropriate? Yeah, if my kids could handle it. And don't get me wrong, like, there are some parts that are probably scarier for some kids more than others. My kids have a relatively high threshold, so know your kids, but definitely go watch it for yourself first, just because it's funny as hell. But then you can watch it with your kids on Halloween. Super fun.
So I'm thinking, in addition to having a Nish and Amy watch Christian conservative movies and throw things at the screen
while we drink heavily.
Yeah. Event. We also need a Nish and Amy watch all the movies Amy's never seen.
We need to watch
and like fill these huge pop cultural gaps.
We gotta watch some Hocus Pocus. There are just some things, Amy, that we're gonna have to educate you on.
Goonies.
Gotta watch the Goonies. Did you watch The Sandlot? Please tell me you watched The Sandlot.
I know the line about Smalls, but see, part of this is I just didn't see things in the 80s. And some of it is our generation difference. When The Sandlot came out, I was like working in the Senate.
Okay, we gotta make you watch The Sandlot too, I guess. We're just gonna start making a list. Anyway, that is my recommendation since it's Halloween, is go watch Hocus Pocus. So that's fine. Yeah. All right, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids!